Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Daniel Foster of National Review Online in for the, not vacationing, but cruising Jim Garrity. The National Review crew is wrapping up. Jim will be back on Monday. Dan's done a great job in Jim's stead over the past week and a half. And
why, thank you.
Absolutely. And Dan, good news, bad news, crazy news, as always. And we start with what we kind of have to twist here a little bit to make good news, because the underlying story is bad. As you and I and Jim and I have said over the weeks, the cylinder story is just abysmal of how the Obama administration let this go. The agenda of pushing this clean energy, possibly making it very financial beneficial to his political bundlers and so forth, with the taxpayers getting the shaft here on this $535 million. So finally, the subcommittee of the House Energy and Commerce Committee on Investigations hears from the Energy Secretary Stephen Chu, who basically says, we did everything right, it just went wrong in terms of eventually this investment not working out. So finally, the chairman of the House Energy Committee was sitting in on this hearing, Fred Upton, and says, okay, over $500 million of taxpayer money is gone. Who gets to apologize for this? And here's what we get from Secretary Chu.
It is extremely unfortunate of what has happened to cylinder. But if you go back and look at the time decisions being made, was there incompetence? Was there was there any influence of a political nature? And I would have to say no.
So no apology?
Well, it is extremely unfortunate that what has happened to Solyndra, and I think you and I both feel the same.
And Secretary Chu goes on to say, how could we know that the solar industry was going to bottom out? Well, there were only red flags for about 2 to 3 years on this that should have told you that funneling more good money after bad was a terrible idea. And so I know this is sounding like a really bad martini, but the good news is that the Republicans on this panel were very well prepared, asked very pointed questions, and showed that unlike the previous Congress, the Obama administration's not going to get away with this political hackery.
I think it is a good martini. I think because this is the sort of thing that happens every day, government intervention in markets, and it's explicitly political. And it took a scandal this size to be able to hold a hearing and basically point out what's a fundamental feature of the American system for the last, 60, 70 years. This market intervention, this picking winners and losers, and especially in the green market where it's just a disaster. I'll tell you the thing that really frustrated me about that hearing yesterday was the Democrats on the committee kept asking Chu if the loan was given on the merits, or was there political influence. Of course, the merits in this case are political. It's written right into the system. I mean, the whole idea for this loan program is that these are companies that a free market would not have chosen to back, right?
Right.
So we don't but this sector is so important, so politically important, and I'll give them credit that it's underwritten by sincere belief that the Chinese are eating our lunch, which I heard 1,000 times yesterday, and that the future is in green energy. But look, right now, inefficiencies, bankruptcies galore, the whole half the hearing was about how the market for solar panels basically collapsed, price collapsed. So I think what's good about this is we finally got to see laid bare that this is at root a political program. And, Secretary Chu is a brilliant man. He's a Nobel Prize winner, and he doesn't understand the fallacy of sunk costs. His answer to a number of questions was essentially, but how could we not restructure their loan? We had already invested so much money in them. We had to throw as much as we could at them to make sure that to minimize the chances that they would go bankrupt. Never mind the fact that their own internal memos were saying that in the best case scenario, Solyndra was going to run out of cash in 2011. It boggles the mind, and it really points out the difference between a free market operating where private investors have to shoulder risk and somebody making decisions for political reasons with other people's money. No private investor would ever utter the sentence, I invested so much in Solyndra, I really ought to double down.
And don't forget, it was Bush's fault. Jan Schakowsky and Henry Waxman and some of these other folks talking about how this was under consideration by the Bush administration late in 2008. And, of course, it was the Bush administration which also said, don't do this. It's not lining up very well. And there were other people in the Obama administration who said the same thing. So the idea that they got caught flat-footed by this collapse is just laughable on the merits, as long as we're talking about on the merits.
Yeah, exactly. And watching Dingell deliver his questions is funny, too. As I pointed out on Twitter yesterday, when John Dingell got to Congress, talk about clean energy. When John Dingell got to Congress, we were 25 years away from catalytic converters in cars. so our mufflers were still spewing Lord knows what out into the air. So clean energy's come a long way since Dingell got a full-time government job.
Yeah, and that's
in 1955.
Exactly right. On to martini number two now. Speaking of stubbornly sticking to your previous political position, Mitt Romney, who was our good martini on Thursday because he's got a 10-point lead over President Obama, reminding us once again on the Neil Cavuto show yesterday why so many Republicans are looking elsewhere for an alternative for the Republican nomination. Give Romney credit. For a guy who's accused often of being a flip-flopper, he's sticking to his guns on the issue of Romney Care. The problem is, it's not worth sticking to. So here's him once again trying to explain why, despite the political advantages of abandoning his previous position on this issue, he's not going to do it because it's just not honest.
And you've seen a lot of candidates look at their biggest vulnerability, just call it a mistake, and ask for forgiveness. In my case, that wouldn't be honest. I believe we did the right thing for our state at the time. It's not working perfectly. The things I'd change in it. If it hurts me politically, that's just the consequence of the truth.
Well, there's a reason, sir, that it's your biggest vulnerability, because it was a major, a big government mandate, the same type of mandate that's headed to the Supreme Court now. And the idea that that type of heavy-handed approach is a good idea in Massachusetts or anywhere else just shows a philosophy that I think a lot of conservatives continue to distrust, and the fact that he keeps defending it gives them good reason to distrust it.
The bad martini here is that he's got this on his record, but I will agree with you that I think of the strategies available to him, this is the best. He's kind of walking a fine line. He's disavowing Obamacare, and he said, you know, he's gone on record 1,000 times saying that he'll issue 50 waivers, you know, if he's elected president to all the states, and that he'll sign repeal and all those. He says all the right things. But I think it would have been worse, and it would have reinforced his position as a flip-flopper if he had disavowed Romney Care. So I think he probably politically is making the right decision. And look, the fact of the matter is this hasn't hurt him nearly as much as a lot of us, including me, thought it would in the primary. Romney Care has not been a major liability. His opponents have been too busy trying to pick each other off, defining themselves as the anti-Romney, to really go after him. We saw that one debate where Michelle Bachmann bailed him out 2 or 3 times. when the knives were at his throat. The bad news for Romney is that there's a poll out in New Hampshire today, which New Hampshire is supposed to be, as we discussed yesterday, you know, red-dyed Romney country. But Newt Gingrich is polling 2 points behind him in New Hampshire today.
Wow.
And that's got to be really scary for him. But, we talked about Gingrich's problems. The problems with his personal life, I think, are potentially major. And we have Kate Trinko reported a piece today on Gingrich's poor polling with evangelical women. That's his disastrous demographic. So that might be real. But on policy, it's good and bad news for Mitt, because if Gingrich is your opponent on policy, Gingrich has had so many different ideas that have fallen in and out of favor on the right over the last 25 years. Any leftist social engineering project that Mitt might have backed, there's a good chance for 6 weeks in 1997, Newt Gingrich also backed that particular program. So that's good news. The bad news is, if it's not going to hurt Mitt, then it's not going to hurt Gingrich. And Gingrich, you know, has, if it's possible, a better mastery of policy. He's certainly as good and perhaps better a debater than Romney. So if Newt hangs around and some of his personal foibles don't bring him down, it's going to be really problematic for Romney.
All right, on to our crazy martini now to wrap up the week. And we touched on it yesterday when we were talking about hitting the $15 trillion mark on our national debt officially. You explained how we're really exponentially above that when it comes to unfunded liabilities. But this super committee now, of course, is getting a ton of attention. November 23rd, next Wednesday, is their deadline to come up with a plan for reducing $1.2 trillion in reduced spending increases over the next 10 years, not actual cuts. And, of course, the hand-wringing is going on. Boehner's blaming the Democrats for having no serious plan to actually cut spending. The Democrats blame the Republicans for not being serious about the amount of tax loopholes, deductions, or even rate increases that they want to entertain. So we're probably headed to a stalemate. At least that's what it looks like for now, which would seem like a good thing if it weren't for the fact that defense could get gutted, but now there's a plan potentially to put that off, that the ramifications of not reaching a deal might actually get scrubbed. So who knows what's happening here? The point is that this was supposed to be this grand exhibition of democracy when, in fact, it's been all behind closed doors, and in the end, nothing's really going to be accomplished that's any good.
Yeah, the killer chart on this is Veronique DeRougie. She has this chart that shows the spending under the sequester, under the trigger, and spending without it. And not only is $1.2 trillion a drop in the bucket when you look at it, but these supposedly draconian cuts that are going to take effect if they fail to come to an agreement aren't that big of a deal either. You can barely see any white space between the two lines of government spending before and after these cuts. And look, I'm one of those conservatives who does think national defense is different. If having the world's largest deterrent military force, if having the ability to project power all over the globe, if being able to fight 2.5 wars simultaneously cost 20% of GDP, I'm basically fine with that. So I've been pretty defensive about these defense cuts. But you know what? It doesn't look like there's a better option right now. And the fact of the matter is that even under the sequester, you would see the Department of Defense getting more money in 2021 than it is getting in 2011. So it's like you said, just the rate of increase in spending is slowing down. So I'm starting to think, like some other conservatives, pessimistic conservatives, I'm starting to join their ranks and think that the best deal we can ask for is no deal. It's one of those things where you really have to be able to trust your adversary, and we just can't in Congress. I mean, I'm with my colleague Kevin Williamson. I would take tax increases if somehow written in blood you could guarantee me that we would see real, meaningful entitlement reform. I think that trade is worth it. The reason that none of us are willing to do it in practice is because we have absolutely no faith that those entitlement reforms will ever happen. The history of this country is that tax increases stick and spending cuts don't.
Yeah, that's been proven from the Reagan era, which the Democrats love to point to, but that's the greatest lesson as to why not to go down that road. George H.W. Bush learned the same lesson. The promises just don't pan out. So good lesson there. Hopefully the six Republicans on the super committee stay strong. We'll find out next week, I guess. Dan, again, thanks so much for pinch hitting for Jim. We'll talk to you later.
My pleasure. Have a good weekend.
Dan Foster of National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus for Radio America. Please join Jim Garrity and I on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.